kind of like go off on.
Listener can't see this, but Ken is getting more excited and Jess is telling him to stop. Stop before he, it's like.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick, and I'm in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke, who's in Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
Very best. I've got the pop filter in front of me, so if you've noticed how crisp and unpoppy my voice is today, you know, listener, it's all for you.
For the American listener, we call that a soda filter.
Exactly, soda filter. Yes. It's only a pop filter and above the border.
That's right.
But I'm being nationalistic here. That's, you know, got that patriotic fervor.
And that's a theme we will return
to. That is a theme we will return to, yes.
And how's your semester going, Ken?
It's going well. Kind of shot out of the gun. I had a realization today when I was talking to one of my grad students is TAing for me, and we've got a lab starting in one of my classes next week. And in my mind, there was a week left in September that there is not.
Yes.
And so, yes. Yeah, so as she pointed out, well, we've got the first lab next Wednesday. And I said, oh, so we do. And so I spent most of yesterday getting the equipment and everything ready. And I have a little shopping list for myself for this weekend to make sure I've got all the stuff ready for the students as they start to work their way through some of the Fort Calgary artifacts.
That sounds very fun. And I wonder if we should maybe get your students on to talk Fort Calgary at some point.
Yeah. Maybe toward the end of the semester here when when they've got a better sense of what's going on. And maybe they'll have, you know, they can give us a lesson in historical archaeology.
That sounds great. And how's Alberta? I believe it was Ian Tyson who said the weather's good there in the fall.
Yeah, maybe. Well, it has been good. It's been very dry. We're back into like drought warnings and, you know, worries about the water levels and everything like that. But, it is, it was 3 degrees this morning, but it'll be 28 or something this afternoon. So
what a life you've chosen, Ken. And so Ken, the listener will just noted that, I've mentioned you're in Alberta and, I'm often in New Hampshire. I'm actually in New Brunswick right now, but I'm in New Hampshire fairly frequently, at least, until the spring. And, that's interesting that we've called this the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast when the defining feature of this actually really is no longer New Brunswick, is it?
No, and I think actually we haven't had any New Brunswick specific content for some time, but we will maybe today in the hit pieces.
We will, yes. There's going to be some New Brunswick in the hit pieces, but Ken, we've also Emmanuel has been encouraging us to try to grow the podcast.
That's right,
and I think that's,
you know, We've got a new help or two. We've got Cody on board.
We do.
You've recently acquired some new audio equipment, and I've got another shopping list for the podcast to go out and get my own version of that that audio equipment.
Yeah, and actually, to give you a sign of how global this thing is, my equipment's actually in New Hampshire, so you're just hearing me on the same equipment you've always heard me on. And sorry about that, Emmanuel. And but so one of the things that we also have, and I think actually really the global nature of the podcast has contributed to this, is that really around the world, Ken, we have some of the sharpest listeners around, I think, don't you?
I think we do, yes.
Yeah,
that is for sure.
And it's a real credit to our listeners that Ken and I treat this podcast really as a conversation, not only with the guest, but with the listener. The listener, of course, can't talk. They can send it mail. But actually, that's how Ken prefers his conversations. And so, but what we would do is we would never, if the listener was like, well, we think we should rename this podcast, we would never just steal that new name, would we, Ken?
No, we wouldn't. We would properly compensate that lovely listener that writes in a new name.
That's right. And where would they send that new name to?
They would be sending that to our Gmail address. And so that's newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled A-R-C-H-A-E-O-L-O-G-Y. You could also send us a direct message or comment on a post on Instagram. And that is @new_Brunswick_archaeology. And archaeology spelled the same way.
That's right. And if we open that mailbox in a fortnight and we found the, what we wanted to be the new name for this podcast, this is the prize we would be extending to the lucky listener. And so, Ken, I'm going to start off here by noting and actually foreshadowing our hit pieces in a little bit. You and I are now noted experts on the Paleo-Indian period. I would say that's safe to say, wouldn't you?
I think, well, we've got a paper out about it, so yeah. I think, and you've got a couple, so, you know, we're in there.
That's right. As we are leading scholars in this region of the Paleo-Indian period, you know, with numerous publications on the topic to our name. And I think that's why the fine folks who operate the prize we have for our listener this fortnight were so interested in partnering with the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. That's right, Ken. As you know, we had a call just recently from a Captain Montgomery Verde. His friends call him Monty, who operates one of the most luxurious cruise lines I've ever seen. It's called Early Man Catamaran, and it specializes offering routes designed to match any, that's right, any of the prose migration routes of the first people into North America. Any routes, you ask, Ken? That's right, Ken. Any. Indeed, even the crazy ones. Indeed, especially the crazy ones. And Ken, you guessed it, we're partnering with Captain Monty to offer the Across Atlantic Ice Cruise. Old Captain Monty has never been one to rest on his laurel leaves, and he's really outdone himself with this one.
Is the ship called the Cimarron?
Oh, it should. We could call it the in homage to the Cinemar Biface.
Cinemar, that's what. Yeah, Cinemar.
Yeah. Oh well. You know what? We're gonna have to suggest that but I think the issue is the Early Man Catamaran refers to a fleet, of which I'm sure that's one of them. You know, the cruise departs, of course, from Marseille, France, known of course for Cosquer Caves and the Salutrian Age hand stencils on the cave wall. And from there, Ken, we're going to find our way across the Atlantic to the Delmarva Peninsula. And at this point, Ken, I think it's time we discuss some of the amenities aboard this vessel. And let me begin, Ken, by just discussing the kitchen on the Early Man Catamaran. It's a Pleistocene fusion restaurant that merges the kelp highway with the caribou, Salutrian sea mammals with Maryland crab. And so the best way to conceive of this, perhaps, Ken, is it's a French bistro, but with a heavy dollop of Old Bay seasoning. And the caribou frites is really to die for on board. And they do quite a nice steamed blue crab starter on a bed of seaweed. It's very nice. And you follow that up with a burger cookie and a macaron tasting plate. It is really, really divine. And Ken, one of the things you and I have probably noticed on the occasional pre-Clovis cruises we've taken is that the drinks menu is usually a little bit limited. It's Miller point time, if you catch my drift, but not on the early catamaran. The cocktail program is notable, not just for its range. You can get a Courvoisier Old Fashioned, a Courvoisier Gin and Tonic, a Courvoisier Manhattan, a Courvoisier on Ice, etc., but for its presentation. Each and every cocktail is served with ice sourced from the Barnes ice cap. And the reason we do that is because science assures us that that's the ice cap that best captures the flavor profile of the Laurentide ice sheet. And if that's not cooler than being ice cold, Ken, I just don't know what is. And Ken, I don't know, have you ever seen those videos of like the Japanese bars where the barman takes the brick of ice and quickly carves it into a perfect sphere?
I haven't, but I have the ice cubes that do that, but just in the freezer.
Okay, well, I'd like you to imagine it actually being chipped into a perfect sphere. And this is actually one he picked up when he was doing the one about the Ainu cruise, the Ainu themed cruise. It's another option here on the Early Man Catamaran. And he sort of takes the big chunks of ice, and to chop them into his fancy sphere, he does it not with a metal fork, but with a big hunk of sweet, sweet South Mountain rhyolite. Or maybe it's a metal rhyolite. Who the hell knows? Rocks aren't real anyway. And why would pre-Clovis people care if it was a rhyolite or a metal rhyolite? And now, Ken, I know the sorts of people who go on a cruise like this would never worry about bad dates. But we've got stuff for folks who are, say, looking to maximize their reproductive fitness. You guessed it, Ken. On Friday nights, we replace the shuffleboard court with an aggregation site, so the ordinarily clicky small bands can swap information about chert, flute some points, and, well, you know. And let me talk a little bit about the scotch list on board here, Ken. So the baseline, of course, is a 13-year-old Balvenie, but as the voyage goes on, barmen with increasingly bushy mustaches appear with a 14, a 16, or even a 22-year-old bottle. That's right, Ken, but that's not all. As the scotch gets older, the barmen ritually fight with one another about which one has the better context. I mean, terroir. It's all part of the show here on the Early Man Catamaran. And now, Ken, Paleo-Indian specialist to Paleo-Indian specialist, I think we can agree that no one has a clue what was going on during this period, probably especially us. But, Ken, Ever since I published my third Paleo Union paper, I've just had a certain sense of invincibility. Sure, I'm a little balder than I used to be, but I think that's because it's migrated to my mustache. But Ken, you don't need to be bald and mustachio to know that this trip is going to be a heck of a good time. And so, Ken, where would the lucky listener send the new name for this show to be launched on the early man catamaran?
Well, to take their journey into the less reliable populating of North America, cruise lines, they would be sending that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. And you can always find us on Instagram at new_Brunswick_archaeology, and archaeology spelled the same way.
That's right. And Ken, if you open up that mailbag like a Paleo Indian disemboweling a caribou, what do you see?
Well, I'd be awful disappointed that was it was actually a caribou decoy, because there's nothing inside.
Nothing in the mailbag.
Nothing in the mailbag other than podmachine.strat sent us an email about saving time on podcasting editing. They obviously, Giselle, the podcast consultant, obviously does not know that we have a crack team. We've got Emmanuel, we've got Cody, we've got all of our bases covered on that. And so, listener, if you've been wanting to weigh in on some of the recent episodes, if you've just got a burning question, or maybe you want to have us talk about something in particular, a site, or explore a topic that you're particularly interested in, we'd be happy to have you write to us at newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com, or find us on Instagram.
How many words is that email address, Ken? Is it all one word?
You messed me up there. I was like,
Ken looks like a man, listener, who's got a few new preps on the books this semester.
Yeah, it's been busy. I also have a kitten who keeps waking us up in the middle of the night to attack our toes. Pickles is awful cute, but Pickles is like having a 2-year-old in the house again that wakes up all the time.
Excellent. Well, that's great though, Ken. We as the listener will know, are quite pro cat on this podcast.
Yeah, in fact, you even have a cat shirt on today.
I have
Bodega Cats.
Yeah, I'm wearing my Bodega Cats t-shirt. That's right.
Is that a band, or is that just a
it is a brand? It's one of the best things going on Instagram. It's like a bodega is like a convenience store in New York.
Yep.
And many of them have cats that work in kind of pest control.
Nice.
And it's an Instagram devoted to taking pictures of cats that live in bodegas.
Very nice.
Yeah, it's okay. Highly recommend it. That should be our hip piece. But before we get to that, we're talking to Jess Robinson today.
We are. Yes, we're gonna take a trip down to Maple Country, south of the border, and talk to Jess about early woodland.
Well, we should say south of the border when we're recording this. Who knows where the border will be by the time this drops.
Yeah, who knows? It's strange times. You never know. Maybe this won't even make it to the air because we're that controversial. So
yeah, well, fingers crossed. Right? And we're going to talk about the early woodland, and we're going to tame the taxonomy a little bit.
Yeah, the archaeology of maple syrup.
Exactly, which is hopefully a forthcoming show, which we should absolutely do.
Yeah. Oh, I listener, when you hear that conversation, you'll want to be there with us.
You will. You absolutely will. And dress warmly.
Exactly.
All right. Well, listener, without further ado, I think Ken and I present Jess Robinson.
Today, we're joined by Dr. Jess Robinson. And Dr. Jess Robinson is a Vermont State Archaeologist, prior to which he taught at the University of Vermont and Johnson State University and worked in cultural resource management archaeology. He earned his PhD and MA in anthropology from the University at Albany SUNY, his MA in Literature from the University of Kent, and BAs in Anthropology and in English from UVM. He's published on topics ranging from Northeast Paleo-Indians to shamans in New France in such journals as Frontiers in Ecology and Evolution, Northeast Anthropology, and Paleo-America, as well as numerous edited volumes. Today he's joining us primarily to help sort out what was going on in the early woodland period, which is the topic of his dissertation. Thanks very much for joining us, Jess.
Hey, thanks for coming on. Very much. Appreciate you guys having me on, and it's good to see you both.
It's good to see you too. We were just actually telling Ken that part of the reason I thought we should get you on to do this, when Matt Betts and I were working on that book, we had you look at a chapter, and you really helped me sort out the early woodland, which was very helpful. And so I guess maybe just before we get started here, though, could you tell us what the Vermont State Archaeologist does and what capacity you're joining us today?
job. I'm employed by the state of Vermont, but I just wanted to mention that I'm speaking to you today as an individual Northeast scholar, and I'm not speaking on behalf of the state of Vermont in this conversation, although I'm happy to answer questions about my role or anything else you might have about that. But my opinions and assertions here are my own.
Terrific. And what does the state archaeologist of Vermont do on a day-to-day basis?
Diverse and varied set of tasks and roles. The Vermont state archaeologist, as opposed to some other states' archaeologist, is placed within the Vermont SHPO, or State Historic Preservation Office. Each state has a version of a State Historic Preservation Office as sort of empowered by the National Historic Preservation Act. And basically, under that federal guidance, we review Section 106 or federal projects that trigger regulatory review under the Nationals. That's our principal role as far as the federal government is concerned. But the Division for Historic Preservation also does a number of things outside of that, as do I. We do state and local reviews. I do a lot of public outreach and policy review. I do things like develop white papers and testify to the legislature about things that might impact archaeology or historic preservation. I run a curation facility. So I'm basically the curator, manager, conservator, head bottle washer of, you know, the facility and everything that comes with that, facilitating research requests and loans and ongoing conservation and consolidation efforts. Do a lot of field visits and public outreach. You know, I'm sure you all deal with this, a steady stream of emails saying, what is this rock? And I found this and a lot of other things besides. So and, you know, hopefully some scholarship and some sort of historic context and, you know, other scholarly pursuits that help guide the practice of rigorous archaeology in Vermont.
That's great.
So I'm sure the listener is also curious. Does the state archaeologist get you know, like an allotted ration of maple syrup or maple creamies? I think that's the name of it, yes. Gabe. Is that the ice cream delight? That's a
There is no shortage of maple creamies, and we are not given a state allotment, although it is a regular occurrence for our division, our agency, and many in state government to avail ourselves of local creamies, and that's often, you know, a summertime treat. You know, get out of work an hour early on a, you know, a collaboration day and go get a creamy maple syrup. Likewise, it's not assigned, but it regularly comes to us through various means, including a lot of fellow employees that are maple sugarers that will bring them in for Christmas gifts, things like that. So yeah, there's no shortage of it.
So are there any state, like, historic sites that are associated with, like, the maple industry, just at, like...
You say that because there are a lot. And, in fact, you know, one of the things that, you know, SWORD's sort of is part of our regulatory framework under the National Historic Preservation Act, which, you know, there's things that Canadians might not be familiar with, but... sites through this regulatory environment have to be determined significant, and that means eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. And then there's various documents that we use to guide, you know, what constitutes eligibility or significance in a particular resource type. And I have been pushing for years to do a historic context of historic maple sugaring sites. We actually know of a lot of them going back to the early 19th century, and I'd love to do sort of a comprehensive review of, like, how the technologies changed and what they look like archaeologically, and, you know, telltale artifact types, synthesis of site locations. So it's not an idle thing. I actually have thought quite a bit about it. It hasn't happened yet, but there are numerous archaeological sites, particularly in the Green Mountain National Forest, where archaeologists have engaged with, you know,
Ken, I think we've just learned what Jess's Very second cool. interview on the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast will be.
Exactly. I think this needs to be like a delicious on-site interview. You know, we'll sit by the, we'll go by the, you know, when there's a boil down going on, we can all hang out outside and
I could, you know, give me enough time. We could facilitate that for next.
All right. Next spring, I'm convinced.
You know.
But I'm sure one thing that we all have in common with Stuart Fidel is not just that we all probably like maple syrup, although I've never met the man, but I assume he does. But we have the question of what happened in the early woodland. And so the period in the Northeast between maybe 3,000 and 2,000 years ago, and as you pointed out in your dissertation, the early woodland interaction spheres you track are among the first large-scale interaction spheres to emerge in North and Mesoamerica. So could you just tell us what these interaction spheres look like archaeologically and how they've been interpreted?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that that is a fair assessment. You know, there were earlier manifestations of regional exchange networks, and regional being quite broad. The Shell Mound Archaic had some, you know, regional exchange networks that went, you know, the Mid-South. There was a sort of Southeastern exchange network. You could argue that Poverty Point is sort of, you know, this interesting fluorescence of extra-regional trade. But apart from those nodes in the lower Mid-South, there's no evidence of other participating. They were gathering materials from disparate locations, but there's no evidence of disparate trade at the ends. When the early woodland comes along, right around 3,000 years ago, you do see the first manifestations of this interregional exchange network, and principally in non-utilitarian materials, or at least materials that were eventually produced into non-utilitarian forms. And that extends everywhere from northern Labrador with Rama Chert, or you know, central northern Quebec with Mistassini Chert, to Nova Scotia copper, Great Lakes copper, Shell from the Mid-Atlantic, potentially down into southern or Gulf Coast waters. Still a little bit unclear. Pipestone from Illinois and Ohio. Chert from various locations from Indiana and Missouri to Ohio. Galena from, you know, potentially other sources, slate, which might come from the Great Lakes, still very much an open question.
There's that figure that has like the grizzly bear teeth coming from the mountain regions. And
well, yeah, but that's interesting because that is Hopewell. So there's right. No grizzly bear, you know, Hopewell gets even, in a certain way, Hopewell gets broader in the sense that you start getting meteoritic iron and grizzly bear teeth from the Rocky Mountains minimally. And the Hopewell interaction sphere extends all the way to the Southeast and, you know, virtually the Gulf and Florida. I mean, there are, you know, some tentative early woodland sites in Florida as well. But what's interesting is, at least in this region, and we can talk about this, but Hopewell does not extend into Vermont or into Maine, or it's very, very lightly represented in Quebec. You know, I know less about the Maritimes in Hopewell, but it doesn't seem to extend that far. It seems, you know, the best well-documented Hopewell, large Hopewell sites or mounds are really in Western New York. It's about as far west as, you know, a major manifestation comes. And so it orients itself away from this far north pattern. But the early woodland, you know, which I do not explicitly characterize as Adena or Adena related, but that's certainly one node of it, is very much involved with the far northeast. Again, all the way up the Labrador coast.
And so what, for the listener, for what distinguishes the early woodland from sort of earlier interaction is that it's not just stuff coming into the region where sort of this like kind of center, it's like ideas are emanating out. And so you're seeing the spread of all this different stuff. And so what are sort of the, so we know that goes into the far northeast, so up into, you know, like New Brunswick and Nova Scotia for sure. What characterizes, you've talked about some of the material culture, but what else is characterized as this early woodland interaction sphere?
Yeah, so we see it rise. I mean, the radiocarbon dates are not voluminous. And in various manifestations, it overlaps into non-mortuary sites. Most notably what's commonly referred to as meadowwood. But by and large, many of these regional manifestations are largely mortuary in nature. They arise right around 3,000 years ago or a little bit perhaps before in the case of some of these regional manifestations known as red ochre or glacial cane. And they extend, as far as we can understand with the available radiocarbon dates, virtually to the year 2000 or slightly before in some of these areas. So it all depends upon the area. Certain areas, you know, most notably the Edina heartland in Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, are most noted for mound building, the emergence of dedicated burial mounds, sometimes with dedicated crypts and elaborate but repeated burial procedures and rituals throughout that Edina area. In the glacial came area, they're defined by the conspicuous burial of individuals or groups of individuals in natural came mounds, although that's not the case in Ontario, where there are no glacial came features, and so there's no mounding. Red ochre in the north has burial mounds, but in the south of its range doesn't. Burial mounds occur, as you probably know, in New Brunswick and in Nova Scotia, but not in Quebec and not in Vermont and not in Maine. But they are defined in terms of its mortuary component by very circumscribed cemeteries, not disparate. Sometimes quite large. At for instance, the Boucher Cemetery, it was quite a small area and yet had approximately 90 burial or cenotaph features with almost no overlap in them, indicating that they must have been marked in some way, and that this cemetery was used for probably about 600 years, perhaps even more, and so repeatedly visited, repeatedly used, and yet marked and added to in a purposeful way. And at least in Boucher, I was able to trace that there's a fair amount of structure to that cemetery. So repeatedly used over time. I argue for a dedicated group of individuals, not just the general populace. But so the range of materials in aggregate is flowing through this broad interaction sphere, and yet the regional manifestations of mortuary complex and in some cases non-mortuary are quite different. And if you look, you know, it in with enough specificity, you can see a lot of different regional and even individual differences. And, you know, I think that's very interesting.
And so just I think that regionalism is actually one of the things that is most confusing, at least for me, about the early woodland. And so I recall, I think in AENA or something years ago, Mike Heckenberger said something about that there are basically all of these terms that describe this seemingly temporally and spatially overlapping phenomena in the early woodland. And so we talk about like the Boucher complex or Edina or Middlesex or all this stuff. Could you just untangle some of that terminology or even just contextualize how we should talk about the early woodland?
And for the listener, when you're listening to this part of the episode, you can pull up Jess's dissertation on page 157. There's a map that could be very helpful for you to kind of contextualize this geographically.
Yeah, and I should note the reason why I even engaged in this is dissertation, when you bring up Heckenberger and another one of the co-authors, Jim Peterson, is he was my Jim Peterson was my mentor, and the Boucher remains, I should say, had long been reburied before I even became an archaeologist. They're respectfully interred and back at the site where they were originally excavated. But there was a long process of analysis of the artifacts and burial features prior to reburial. And all that material was sitting, you know, in shelves and, you know, it completely analog. None of it had ever been digitized. And when Jim passed away, it was one of the things that made me think, well, you know, this has already been subject to analysis. This data is there. It was Jim's great unfinished project. And so I sort of took it upon myself, but I never engaged with any of these materials directly. This was purely an archival analysis. So that's a caveat. and so that was the one of the starts of thinking about my dissertation, even as I entered graduate school. I, like you brought up, was originally confounded by all these terms and the broad sweep of the interaction sphere and all of these sort of tropes that were kicking around the literature, like the Adena interaction sphere was the most notably, and the Adena was the heartland from which things sort of diffused to these outer peripheries. When I started looking in detail, it just didn't make a lot of sense. And Heckenberger, Peterson, and colleagues noted that. The Adena phenomenon, as remarkable as it sort of was late in the sequence, as far as we can tell from the radiocarbon dates. The other ones, Meadowood, Glacial Came, Red Ochre, roughly 500 or more years, in disparate parts of the eastern woodlands. And so part of it was tracking the geographic and then chronological parameters of it. And chronologically, Red Ochre, Glacial Came, Meadowood, Middlesex have almost no differentiation. It's possible, and it's perhaps likely, that Red Ochre and Glacial Came emerged slightly earlier, that they were slightly earlier manifestations, and Meadowood and Middlesex, which are essentially the same thing. There really is no differentiation.
And the idea is that Middlesex is the mortuary component and Meadowood is the habitation sites.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you really parsed out, there might be an earlier sort of manifestation, but it blends very quickly into, the same thing. It's really not a valid taxa as far as I'm concerned. Spatially, there is a lot of spatial integrity in what has been called Red Oak, and then what has been called Glacial Came, and what has been called Adena. And then Meadowood Middlesex is all just this northeastern manifestation, which, doesn't have a lot of geographic integrity yet. I mean, geographic specificity. They blend into one another. And all of these things are very interesting because they emerge, archaeologically very rapidly to synchronously, at least as far as we can tell with the currently available dates, but they have different notable, distinctive, characteristic artifact forms with them. So Glacial Came, which is the, inland, freshwater glacial lake-centered mortuary phenomenon, is defined by presence of marine shell, most notably. That's sort of, some of the most indexical artifacts of this mortuary complex are marine shell gorgets, what are called sandal shell gorgets. Red ochre is defined by these turkey tail, hypertrophic blades, which are almost uniformly made from Wyandotte chert from Indiana. And these Morse knives, which are actually made from Crescent Hill chert in Missouri. Meadowoods are defined most notably by Meadowood cash blades, which are, not exclusively, but largely made from Western Onondaga chert around the Eastern Great Lakes into sort of central New York region. But then there's a lot of differences and interesting overlap that hint at connections between them. For instance, Ontario glacial came sites have Meadowood blades in them and, bird stones. The Boucher site has a circular shell gorget. There's very interesting things while largely maintaining some distinctiveness, even at the individual site or cemetery level.
Right. And so that's very helpful. And so in the Northeast, then, you kind of hinted at this, we've got some hints of interaction, I guess, across this vast area, but we have some fairly specific manifestations of early.
What's interesting is, so Vermont has, four known early woodland cemeteries that have been called Middlesex, previously. The Swanton site, the Boucher site, and which are only about, 20 kilometers away from each other. in northern Vermont in the Swanton Highgate area, and then in the other near to Lake Champlain, the northern end of Lake Champlain, and then in the southern Lake Champlain area, there's the East Creek site and the Bennett site, which I didn't look at, which was completely looted in the 1940s, but Ritchie did take photographs of that, and you can see those in pre-Iroquoian occupations in New York State. I should say that with the East Creek site, I did work with the permission of the Stockbridge Munsee Mohican, and they agreed to all my research, which again was not obviously excavation, but was engaging with the curated artifacts and extant archives. So
that's great.
Just wanted to note that. What I noticed in the analysis of those was that they're separated by less than 100 miles on either ends of Lake Champlain. Lake Champlain would have facilitated easy travel up and down the lake. Certainly not a huge distance between them, and yet they evinced very different artifact inclusions through time, persistently, and affinities with seemingly different nodes of this broad interaction sphere. So, for instance, at the Boucher site, there was a significant amount of northern lithic materials, Rama chert, Mastassini chert, perhaps argillite from Quebec. None of that was at East Creek. At East Creek, there was an affinity with turkey tail blades, including one from Indiana that was made of Wyandotte chert, others that were made of more regional materials, but nevertheless copied the form. There wasn't a single shell artifact at Creek, and yet they were fairly common at Boucher in terms of beads and other items of adornment. Meadowwoods were very common at East Creek. There wasn't a single one at Boucher. So what it suggests is there was a select number of exchange partnerships that I argue were established and then cultivated through time. These people, either by choice or by ability, didn't have access to the full range of materials circulating throughout the interaction sphere. Rather, they, I argue they cultivated relationships with one or more partners. Through time, those materials likely took on specific connotations important to those groups.
Yeah, so these are overlapping in time, but it looks like they're kind of operating in exclusionary trade relationships despite kind of participating in this bigger idea. Eh?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So what is the relationship between the mortuary and the non-mortuary sites? I was talking to Gabe about this when we were going to get you on the show. I remember you did a paper at ESAF years ago where you were looking at like viewscapes or something like that between Boucher and I think it was one of the habitation sites. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes. And so this is really interesting because in Swanton, where the Boucher site is located, is currently sort of a peninsula defined on one side by the Missisquoi River and on the other side by an oxbow. Doing some geomorphological analysis and extrapolation, it seems pretty clear that at the time Boucher was actively being used as a cemetery, it was an island in the Missisquoi River. But notably, this sort of island or peninsula-like landform continued to be used up through and beyond the contact period as a cemetery space for the Abnaki. We have evidence of late woodland contact period cemetery on another part of the peninsula. So it powerful testimony to the fact that this was a sort of sacred landform through time, all the way to the contact period. And eventually we do find, habitation evidence on this landform where we've seen it in like eroding banks or in very targeted excavations for things like small construction things that we monitor on this road. But during the early woodland period, it appears that it was not occupied at all for habitation. All the habitation sites that we know about were on the other side of the Missisquoi. And we do see small early woodland habitations, and that characterizes all the early woodland sites in Vermont. They're very small. We don't know of any major habitation sites, maybe near the East Creek area in Orwell, indicated by some artifact collections, but no professionally excavated large early woodland sites. And yet the mortuary component was very long-lived, very, very elaborate, and very broad. But there virtually no overlap. Nearby, but no overlap.
That's really interesting. And so
interesting.
What our theme, supposedly, this season of the podcast, Jess, is social complexity. And actually, what you just outlined is maybe a tension here in trying to think about social complexity in the early woodland. But one of the things that you've also worked on is that these massive ritual spheres have a whole bunch of evidence for social differentiation when we think about so-called simple societies. And you pointed out that argued that it might have been maintained by aggrandizers with esoteric knowledge who were also aided potentially by seeming to be able to respond to climatic conditions. Could you tell us more about this? I really like this idea, and I think it's super interesting.
Yeah, I mean, so when I was, when you really look at this mortuary evidence, you see a lot of, I should say that framing the overall early woodland period, you see, I did a chapter where I tried to the very best of my ability, and I am not an environmental scientist, and so it took a lot of effort and extrapolation and asking colleagues, but I think I made a pretty convincing case, guided by a number of other more expert scholarly treatments in the environmental sciences and Fidel's work and other archaeologists, that there is an environmental downturn that likely begins earlier, in the Susquehanna horizon, but becomes much more evident by 3,000 years ago. When I say downturn, I mean things became colder and wetter. And there's various proxies, lake levels, particular tree species abundance, paleostorminess that seem to indicate this, and I think that may have been there might be myriad other factors that the archaeological record doesn't reveal, but I think that might have been a catalyst for social change. Certainly, in Vermont, site sizes and the numbers of sites decline from previous periods, as far as we can tell archaeologically, and that might be a proxy for tentative proxy for population sizes. Looking at this data, in a straightforward way as a grad student, you might think, oh, these are precisely the wrong conditions for, emerging social inequality, social aggrandizement. There's a whole corpus of literature about crisis conditions and the emergence of particular forms of leadership and aggrandizement. What I began to see is that, you can't, if everything is more tenuous, these aren't the conditions to manipulate, resources of abundance that, you can, for instance, manipulate all of the maize surplus to elevate yourself beyond your peers. But it might be precisely the conditions whereby, if you control esoteric knowledge, reductively termed as shamanism, the control of the supernatural, or intercede on behalf of the populace towards the supernatural, manipulate things towards better ends, then you might be able to accrue power beyond those privileges usually accorded to you.
Yeah, this is how I run my intro class, actually.
Yeah, I mentioned it in my dissertation, but I actually I published a paper in 2021 where I actually sort of in Northeast Anthropology where I actually looked at this in terms of contact period, and basically there's obviously profound crisis conditions for many, if not most, native groups at the onset of colonialism and sustained, contact, the imposition of market economies, the imposition of religion, disease. And, obviously the records there are biased, but looking principally at the Jesuit relations in a New France, what you see is the shamans were first The Jesuits' main sort of, you know, they were perceived as the most powerful impediment to the conversion. They were the ones that were feared. They spent most of their energy trying to belittle them, to undermine them. And the shamans themselves seemed to have accrued inordinate amounts of prestige. And that manifested where we can see in the chronicles in a lot of payment for services rendered. You know, they were exempted from hunting and other mundane tasks. They were given lots of gifts you know, using that as an analog, you can see that potentially similar things may have occurred 3,000 years ago, that when you're in a situation of crisis, you turn some portion of the populace will turn towards, you know, the magical religious practitioners to try to, you know, receive, you know, relief from their maladies. And that might have a material component to them, either materials that are accrued as gifts, but also things that are used in these ceremonies and that connote prestige by having them, wearing them.
So these could be your exotic items, your big elaborate burials, your blocked end tubular pipes from who knows where, all these kinds of things.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the accumulation of that stuff must have been really rapid because these ideas move very rapidly, right? Like this is all happening kind of, you know, like, so to, you know, this view from the far northeast for us is, for example, Augustine Mound is a very famous site. And the dates of the earliest components at Augustine Mound are among the, you know, around 2800-ish, which means that very early on, you know, these ideas and these aggrandizers or these, you know, very powerful individuals have created networks that extend right to sort of the end of the, you know, the end of the world, I guess, on the East Coast. And so, like, do you have an idea of how those processes work? Are these, you know, like how they must have been, it must have been rapid, right? And, you know, facilitate, they must have emissaries or people that are going out to share this idea, or is it that they've accumulated that social capital so quickly that they themselves are traveling to kind of share the...
The listener can't see this, but Ken is getting more excited and Jess is telling him to stop before he... It's like...
No, I was just going to say, it's the biggest question, and it's been thought about not so much in the early woodland context, but people have thought about this in the Hopewell context. It's equally, you know, there's equally different possibilities. Like you said, Ken, it could be that, you know, part of the whole process was actually like these pilgrimages of adventure to go out and acquire these exotic things and bring them back directly. You know, it could be that, you know, these people of prestige cultivated specific trade relationships, and that you know, these were held on very, very tightly. You know, one of the things I read was that that I took a lot of interest in was that the Huron developed trading partners, and that, you know, they would hold on to these trading relationships with, you know, different European entities, and what they valued was the relationship. And so they weren't interested in sort of the market economics of it. You know, they would want the same price every year, you know, for the same amount of thing, because it was a cultivation of the relationship. It wasn't the end line recipient. It was, you know, sometimes it was just that relationship itself. And I thought about that as sort of an analog, you know, that might pertain, but there's a number of other, you know, was it down the line and it's just when people passing, they would grab it? I don't think so. I think that these relationships, even far flung, were maintained and you know, I don't want to say nurtured, but, you know, this wasn't casual. Or it might be that they went and got them themselves. It's entirely unclear. Likewise, is it unclear, like, what was being traded out of Vermont? You know, don't really know. Jim Bradley, scholar who's worked a lot on the Onondaga, but, you know, with everywhere from the Paleo-Indian period to the early woodland period, you know, a number of years suggested to me that in the slate belt of Vermont and adjacent eastern New York is really the only area where you can get reliable abundant red slate, which is a prominent material in the early woodland interaction sphere. Maybe that is a commodity that was being traded out. You know, Karine Taché has maybe talked about fish oil as being a commodity that was traded. You know, people bring up furs. You know, not really sure. You know, it's a little bit of a mystery, partly because it's those materials, with the exception, potential exception of red slate, weren't durable. So yeah, that's a great question, Ken. I do not know the mechanisms. I can speculate, but I, you know, it's not clear.
And you know, like, I'm interested in the late woodland, and it's so different from the late woodland where you have examples of these big, like, kind of aggregations or like bigger sites and stuff like that. And my understanding is that you don't really see that in the early woodlands. So it's not like people are coming together in one spot to exchange all this stuff, like how we envision other periods.
No, I mean, there are large early woodland sites. You know, I think of Batiscan and Pointe de Boisson, but even there, no evidence of sort of coming together, this sort of trade fair model that, that has been hypothesized in other contexts. You just don't really see it. The possible exception is the Delmarva Peninsula, where the sites down there are extremely complex and filled with a lot of exotic material from all over the early woodland interaction sphere. And, you know, Darren Lowry, who's done work on that, you know, suggests that part of the sort of abundance might be because they were sort of the brokers of shell, you know, whelks, olivella, shark's teeth, that they're all very abundant on the Delmarva Peninsula. So that might be a way to look into at least one node of that. But, you know, still, you need to look at a lot of different things to get at it, and it's hard to.
The Delmarva Peninsula never makes anything in North American archaeology easier, does it?
No.
But so, Jess, while we're all in a speculative mood, I wondered if I could ask you to sort of bookend the early woodland a little bit, and like, do these relationships lead to either what causes the early woodland cultural phenomenon to happen coming out of the transitional or terminal archaic, and then what do you think causes this phenomenon to end?
Yeah, it's a great question. I am not entirely sure what causes it to end, but what's notable is again, getting back to how we sort of started in talking about the Hopewell, other parts of the continent, Hopewell just comes right out of Adena and gets more elaborate and more complex and very conspicuous. That's when you see, you know, like the ton of Wyandotte chert discs being you know, interred in burial mounds, and you know, and then there's the ritual processionals, and you know, various you know, astrological alignments emerge, and the mounds get very complex. But in Vermont, and in adjacent areas, burial elaboration, non-local exchange, even the manufacture, as far as we can tell, archaeology of non-utilitarian, you know, durable goods, just drops off. There's no burial elaboration at all that we see in Vermont. And yet the number of sites increases. Early middle woodland pottery, defined most notably by pseudoscallop shell decoration, you know, is very abundant. And so my assertion in my dissertation, which I haven't seen anything since then to really refute this, is that things got better and or people were able to reorient their, you know, lifeways to accommodate newfound environmental, potentially political and social regimes. And they said, okay, you know, we don't need to invest all of this surplus energy into our, you know, magical religious practitioners anymore. And that, you know, falls off completely for a few hundred years. Interestingly, some amount of non-local exchange emerges again in what's called the Jack Serif horizon, but it's much more limited. And really, there's three materials that we see in the Jack Serif horizon here in Vermont with some regularity: non-local materials, Onondaga chert, Pennsylvania jasper, and Rama Chur is still in. And so it nothing really further west than that, you know, much more oriented, you know, sort of along the Atlantic seaboard inward to, you know, central New York is about as far as it goes. But it's an interesting, you know, sort of, you know, up, down, up trajectory for non-local exchange in any case.
And it's interesting, too, like that pattern in Vermont is basically the same as what we see in the Maritimes, right? Like it's, you know, the Middlewood. And so it, with Vermont, too, do you see the same kind of like there's speculation that there's like a population boom basically in the Middle Woodland in the Maritimes. And I'm guessing that's, is that kind of the same thing that you guys see in Vermont?
Definitely. Yeah. And again, you know, I always, when I teach a class, I always tell my students that there's no more thankless, you know, job in archaeology than demography, because, you know, it's so difficult. But yes, using the proxies of site numbers, site sizes, ubiquity of artifact classes, things like that. Yes, it seems impressionistically very likely that there was a population increase around 2000 years ago.
That's the chert per square mile approach to, Yeah,
pottery decoration per square mile. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And again, you know, referring to that sort of ethnohistoric paper I wrote, under normal circumstances, you know, indigenous groups, you know, were fairly, you know, circumspect of their shamans or, you know, or magical religious practitioners. You know, they were seen as powerful, but they were also, you know, sort of viewed with suspicion and there were sort of power negation strategies that were normally in play to sort of neutralize the aggrandizement of a potential shaman. And you know, what I argue is in situations of crisis or perceived crisis, those power negation strategies might be suppressed or go out the window. But when things get back to normal, they can come back into play, you know, which I think is one reason I argue that these power asymmetries didn't asymmetrical and grow into, you know, established, you know, codified positions of prestige through time.
You on the spot here, but could you give us an example just of one of those power neutralization strategies? That's really interesting.
Yeah, well, Lafayette, you know, talks about numerous instances with the Mohawk where they will, you know, and this breaks down into if it's, you know, we have to interpret what he was saying because they use all these derisive terms like juggler and medicine man. But basically what he was saying is there's two types of magical religious practitioners. There are the healers, which do good. And then there's, you know, what he calls the magicians or, you know, you might call conflict shamans or, you know, other things that they've been called in, say, Amazonian contexts that, you know, are thought to wield spells towards, you know, perceived enemies or anyone else. And, you know, Lafayette says that they, you know, they on numerous occasions tried to kill those perceived, you know, evil shamans, and that the shamans would have to, you know, do, you know, massive displays of propitiation, giving up wampum and other things to try to, you know, quell the suspicion that they were acting, you know, against the best wishes of individuals within the community or the community at large. And, you know, it was very, very common to think that, you know, shamans in enemy communities, rival communities, were engaging in malevolent actions against them, casting spells. And then there were you know, things that the populace would do to try to negate those spells. And, you know, their own shamans would be engaged in sort of ritualized warfare against those enemy shamans and things like that. So, you know, there was a lot of that going on, but it you know, I think in normal times, it engendered a climate of circumspection against this. You needed them, but you didn't, you know.
You didn't need them all the time. Well, so Gabe caught this and I didn't. And before we're going to jump off of early woodland for a moment here. And You have an academic background in literature. So how did that come about, and how do you think the emphasis on narrative and story, like I think the listener can probably pick up on this in the way that you're able to talk about what's going on in the early woodland. How's that changed your perspective?
And he uses phrases like massive displays of propitiation, which is, I mean, that's an MA in literature.
It sort of stumbled into it backwards or accidentally, in the sense that I went to a small private school, Catholic, and I felt sort of constricted or restricted there. But the one outlet there wasn't things like anthropology or anything else. It was a very rigid program. But the one thing I really gravitated towards was literature. And that was, by far my best subject in high school, and where I became an avid reader and loved literature for its ability to reveal things in eloquent, novel, and inspired ways about the human condition and humanity. And so I went into the University of Vermont wanting to be an English major, and that was my declared major. And then, my freshman year was the last year that actually you had to go in and just leaf through in these giant rooms. You had to leaf through these big, paper catalog books of all the course offerings that you could take as a freshman before it all went online the following year. But I was leafing through and, started with A and saw anthropology, and it was Introduction to Archaeology. And I, had always been interested in archaeology passively, reading National Geographic. And I thought, oh, this is really cool. And I felt this immense sense of freedom, like, oh, I can take this class. This is amazing. And so I took Introduction to Archaeology, and it was revelatory. And then the following year, I took... the following semester, I took another class. And then the following year, I took a class by, who became the person who became my very good friend and mentor, Jim Peterson. And that really sort of cemented it. And so I said, well, this is what I want to do. But I realized I could just do a double major. I didn't have to give up literature. And so went through being a double major, and there's a thing, I got a scholarship my senior year to go over and study in England and on a literature scholarship, and then came back and immediately started doing CRM archaeology. But like most new CRM people, I got laid off when the snow began to fall and the ground froze, and ended up working, in a bakery, waking up at 3:30 in the morning to bake bread. And I was sort of, as a new graduate with this newly minted undergraduate degree.
And this is where your mother said, what did you think you were going to do with a double major in anthropology and English?
Exactly. And so I got an offer to go back to that place where I, spent my senior year on scholarship, the University of Kent, to do a master's degree. And I took it. And so I got there, and about 2 weeks into my graduate courses, I realized I did not want to pursue this as a career. That by that time I realized, as much as I love literature and how much it revealed things about the human condition, it was sort of a looking through a mirror, and I realized archaeology is a much more direct way to get at what humans were doing in the past. And so I carried out my degree, had a great time in England, and then came back and did archaeology ever since. So that's how
That's a fantastic story.
Yeah. What was your thesis on in English?
The symbolic use of violence in works by William Faulkner and Cormac McCarthy was my master's dissertation.
Oh, wow. Okay. Cool.
Been a long time ago. I wouldn't be able to say much more beyond that. I stumbled across a hard copy of my master's thesis a little while ago. I couldn't even read it. I picked it up and was like, I can't look at it anymore.
We'll try to call the episode Blood Meridian or something, just in homage to it. Yeah. Well, thanks very much for joining us about this, Jess. This was a really interesting conversation, and it was nice to chat with you about your thesis, because we'd corresponded a bit about it explaining some things for me, which I really appreciated. So it was good to have this conversation.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on. This is great. And you know, unpacking the early woodland, I think, is always helpful.
Yeah, happy to do it. Good to see you guys.
Thanks, Jess.
Thanks again.
Well, Ken, I think it's time for Hit Pieces.
I think it is.
And we've got a couple of exciting hit pieces today, and one of them is by us, as well as Trevor Dow, Josh Cummings, and David Black, and that is called Diagnostic Late Paleo-Indian Lancelet Projectile Points from New Brunswick, Canada, and that's in Paleo America, a journal of early human migration and dispersal, cite early, cite often, listener. And Ken, what's this about?
This paper is about some work that we've been doing on a collaborative project working with Wolastoqiyi Nation in New Brunswick, and we've talked about it on the show before, the Bailey Project. And in the course of doing some of the lab analysis for the Bailey Project, we came across a group of four artifacts in that collection that struck us as awfully reminiscent of what our fairly diagnostic late Paleo-Indian lancelet forms. And so in the far northeast in general, we have there are two sort of characteristic styles of projectile points that were being made. The Saint Anne Varney type, which are kind of these long, elegant, square-based lancelet points. And then there are these shouldered points that are grouped into
the agate basin related.
You could tell I didn't look at this one before you reviewed this one. I thought you were going to talk about it.
Oh, sorry, listener. Yeah.
And so when we discovered these, we were immediately excited because we actually have a very poor understanding of this time period in New Brunswick. And so we have a little bit of information about the early Paleo-Indians, so the earliest groups in the region. You obviously have DeBert in Nova Scotia, but there's the Penfield site in southern New Brunswick. There's also an earlier Paleo-Indian site just outside of Fredericton in just outside of Marysville. Prior to this, I think there was only three or four recorded instances of late Paleo-Indian points in New Brunswick. And there has been an argument made recently that this might be pointing to people leaving the region after the early Paleo-Indian period. So as the onset of the Younger Dryas period, and toward the end of the Pleistocene and Holocene transition, that the environment in New Brunswick was maybe inhospitable. And so one of the things that we saw in this was, okay, well, there are four points here. And then colleagues, so Josh and Dave went back and looked through a collection that's at UNB, the George Frederick Clark Collection, and on kind of revisiting that collection and discovering there were four points in that collection that looked very characteristic of this. And what it indicated was that in two historic collections, we've identified eight projectile points from this time period, a number of which appear to cluster in around the lower Wollastoog and in the Lakes District, sort of surrounding Grand Lake in that area. And what we were able to do by looking at these is argue that perhaps one of the things that we, this lack of understanding about the late Paleo-Indian period is actually more to do with some history and maybe the archaeology surrounding it, right? There have not been any, there's only been one targeted survey sort of looking to identify the kinds of landscapes and places where you might find these late Paleo-Indian sites. It actually did not find any of those sites. And there are very few of these artifacts surrounding. And so what we're arguing is that maybe some of the archaeology work surrounding this is one piece of it. But the other is that maybe we need to start looking at some of these other collections and thinking about having an eye to these particular class of artifacts. We might actually identify more.
Indeed, it seems possible that the dearth of late Paleo-Indian period sites is a product of research focus rather than past settlement patterning, Ken.
And that's a direct quote, folks. You can take that to the bank.
And it's from the abstract, even. So even if you don't want to read the whole paper, you can just look at the picture and read that line.
Yeah. And so pretty exciting, kind of neat. It's been exciting to be able to share research results from that project, kind of the first piece of it. And a really important part of New Brunswick history, and I think doing a part in kind of rebuilding a better understanding of the culture history in New Brunswick too, and right, and making the argument that depopulation models have to be used very carefully.
That's right. And that was, I should say, a lot of fun to work on. And we're grateful to our co-authors and to WNNB and also to the archives here at UNB.
Yeah. Yeah. And we want to highlight too, Dallas and Kira, who were students that were helping us out with this and are involved with the project. And I think it was Dallas like identified, drew attention to the first point and said, hey, this one looks a little bit different. so great. Is that parallel flaking?
Yeah. And the next thing we've got here is regional disparities in U.S. media coverage of archaeology research. I think this one, I thought this one was kind of interesting, Ken. And, oh, sorry, I should say it's in Science Advances, Volume 11, Issue 27. And what this one points to is that they're basically where archaeological sites are from seems to have a lot to do with whether or not they get reported in popular media.
Yeah. So it seems to show a bias toward North American, European, and Judeo-Christian archaeology as getting media attention. And what's really interesting is, so we had Maddie McLeister on here not too long ago. And one of the things that they point out is that there are two journals in particular. And one of them, it's Science and, I lost my notes here, Science and... Nature.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. So if you get a journal article in Science or Nature, something like 90% of archaeology papers that land in those journals end up being distributed through popular media, right?
Ken, we should make a point to contact the 10% that don't. We should have a special, like B-sides and rarities from Science and Nature.
Yeah. So if you go through the supplementary data on this paper, you'll probably be able to pull out which papers didn't make the cut. But
they have to be more boring than watching paint dry.
but one of the things that they're drawing attention to is that there are, for example, Southeast Asian and like Chinese archaeology seems to be selectively excluded from these media stories, which shows media bias and, you know, possibly kind of these enduring racist media biases about archaeological narratives. And the other thing is, it's kind of interesting. And so for archaeologists who are thinking about like building their profile and their visibility of the work that they're doing, what they're saying is that, you know, if you get in Science or Nature, you're going to get widespread media coverage. But it's interesting that then they go to other kind of top tier journals. Like, so for example, Antiquity, Science Reports, Nature Communications, all of which have really high impact factors. There doesn't seem to be any kind of statistically significant difference between exposure in these other. So there's actually two journals sort of that kind of carry the weight. And there's a couple of strategies that you can use to to promote your research in different ways.
And one of those strategies is to publish in Science or Nature.
One of them is to publish in Science and Nature. Another is to be part of this Eureka Alert, which is a science news release feed service. And then the other is something that, interestingly, they draw attention to is to publish your paper and then write about it in journals like, for example, Scientific American, The Conversation, or there's The Conversation Canada, and then Sapiens. And we talked, I think, last episode about how Sapiens is disappearing. And so one of the things that's interesting to point out is that one of the avenues that researchers have done to get their research out to a broad public has now disappeared, right? And so you can imagine that right. And so for the listener that's not familiar, Scientific American, The Conversation, Sapiens, what they usually try to do is they like you to have an article published. And then essentially what you write is a public summary piece about that article that is then linked in there. And that can get you promotion a little bit wider. And so working with colleagues, we have a paper that's coming out fairly soon. And we've got a pre-written Conversation Canada article to go with that to get that promotion piece bumped up a little bit.
Excellent. Well, Ken, I think that's our hit pieces for today, but we've got more coming. It's been a good harvest season in Northeast archaeology, I think, and we're looking forward to talking to the listener in a fortnight.
Yeah. So yeah, we've got lots coming down the pipe here, listener, and some interesting interviews coming up. As always, you know, like, follow, subscribe,
share with your friends.
Share with your enemies.
Throw
us a 5-star. Throw us a review. And we do love getting mail. So newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. Reach out to us on Instagram at new_brunswick_archaeology. And as we get our game plans together here, probably lots of exciting stuff coming down. You know, we're always looking forward to maybe the next live show. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll try to make that happen in the near future.
If you're a listener who owns a, you know, ideally a kind of local bar and would like to lend it to us, yeah, that would be fantastic.
That can seat, you know, 20 to 50 people.
Yep.
You know, has mellow acoustics, I think, is the other thing that we're looking for.
It is, but we're willing to trade acoustics for free.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Plus, we'll have all this new equipment that we get to play with.
Absolutely. So we can, the listener may remember the last one, Ken and I are very, very astute at setting up a PA system. And so so stay tuned for that, listener.
Dallas and Trevor actually saved our butts on that one, mm-hmm. actually, you know, so that's, you know,
they yeah, sure
that's,
did.
That's a true research team right there.
It really is. And well, Ken, I think I'm looking at a half finished bottle of Courvoisier, and I think we're up against your heart out.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to go get some children and from school, and we will see you in a fortnight, listener.
Talk to you soon, listener.